We're broadcasting from the Jerome L. Green space here at WNYC. And my next guest is Christopher Andrew. The British Security Service, or MI5, has been veiled in secrecy for a century, and successive governments in Britain have all wanted it that way. But now, to mark its centennial, MI5 has given unprecedented access to Mr. Andrew, opening the 400,000 files from its beginnings to the present day. The resultant book, Defend the Realm, the authorized history of MI5, is not only a comprehensive history of the service, it also sheds new light on a side of British and international history that has long remained secret. It's published by Knopf. I'm very pleased it has brought Christopher Andrew to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
What led the British government to break with its traditional secrecy policy involving MI5? I mean, there's an Official Secrets Act in England that's a lot more stringent than anything we have in this country.
Well, this is a large proposition. I don't know if I can persuade you of it, Leonard, but it could be said that the British government at last grew up. You know, it wasn't till 1992 that the British government at long last admitted that we actually have a foreign intelligence service.
Oh. Everybody knew there was MI5. I mean, didn't we have
James Bond? I hope you didn't tell anyone.
John le Carré and all of that?
Well, of course, everybody knew it. In the end, it just became, you know, the subterfuge became so silly. And made it possible to happen is that people could write incredibly silly stuff about what MI5 had done and more frequently what it hadn't done. And you know, the name Peter Wright, some people remember, and I think you will. Now, the book was complete nonsense, but he managed to pull off a real publishing coup. He got the book banned by Her Majesty's government, and even though the book was worthless, being banned by Her Majesty's government ensures a sale of at least 1 million in the United States.
And got him on our show many years ago.
Well, that's right. Now, if only I could get my book banned, I would do as well as him. But anyway, we'll see.
But forgive me for asking you this. Why were you, of all the historians of Britain, chosen to be given almost unrestricted access to MI5's files?
Well, because of my natural modesty.
Of course.
I'm not unable to think of a credible reason, so forgive me for starting off with an incredible one. No, I mean, I've been a historian all my life. I've taken a particular interest in intelligence communities. The CIA, I don't know whether you'll think this is a good thing or not, but my history of how American presidents use intelligence is still something that is given to new analysts when they...
So they figured that you'd know what you were reading when you looked through the files.
I think that's the case. And then, of course, also I come from Cambridge University. Now, Leonard, your university will have sent people into the intelligence services. I've no doubt of that. But let's face it, it was probably into the intelligence services of our own side. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. But Cambridge, I regret to say, has a more cosmopolitan attitude to intelligence recruitment. Some of our best people have got into the other side as well.
Cambridge supplied a lot of counter spies.
Well, that is...
The Cambridge Five. Kim Philby.
The KGB always called the Cambridge Five, the five superstars who joined the KGB, the Magnificent Five. KGB loved Westerns. So when the great box office success, the Magnificent Seven, came out in 1960, they started calling my colleagues from Cambridge the Magnificent Five.
According to The Economist, you had to be officially recruited into the MI5, and you underwent a security vetting before they would allow you to view the files. Is that true?
It wasn't quite like that, but I wasn't initially in favor of joining MI5 while I was writing the book. But in the end, I think that that I was. And I think the reason is this. It doesn't really matter what the organization is. If you come in as an outsider, people don't talk to you in the way that they do if you're an insider. So I think I learned a lot more by becoming a member of the service. And here's a sneaky technique that I'd recommend anybody writing the history of anywhere. Just spend a lot of time going up and down in the lift. Mm-hmm. You know, you get the mood music. You discover whether people are positive or negative. And I can now let you into a classified secret. The lifts in MI5 move extremely slowly.
How extensive was your access? Did they let you see everything?
Yes.
I'm assuming there was an understanding that there were certain things that would have to remain secret.
Oh, of course. But, you know, if you're writing a book based on access to all the files, one of the things you should seek to make sure is that what you publish on the basis of files whose material you can release is not contradicted by the files you can't release. So I spent just as much time looking at files that couldn't be published as I did files that could be published.
And what sorts of things can't be published? I'm not asking you to reveal them here, but on a broader level.
The kind of things that can't be published essentially have to do with the identity of agents and, you know, precisely how you go about bugging, for example. MI5 bugged the headquarters of the British Communist Party from 1942 until the British Communist Party died of boredom at some point in the mid-1980s. So it would be unfair of me to describe, even to you, Leonard, how to do that.
My guest is Christopher Andrew, who's written Defend the Realm, the Authorized History of MI5. It's published by Knopf. Now, I know about MI5 and MI6, but that would suggest that there was an MI1, an MI2, an MI3, and an MI4. What does MI stand for?
Yeah, you're not cleared for that, Leonard. No, what actually happened is that there were lots of MIs during the First World War. Most of the others died out, and, you know, they could have changed. But, you know, once you become known as anything, you may as well stick with it. So MI6, for example, the James Bond outfit, was actually originally called MI1C, but it was just too confusing. Actually, the official title of MI5 is not MI5. It's the security service. But, you know, once people know you as MI5, you may well as well stick with it.
And MI would stand for military intelligence?
MI, in the First World War, stood for military intelligence. That's right.
According to your book, the British Security Service at its inception was surprisingly rudimentary.
Incredibly rudimentary, but it just shows what
you could... Two people in 1909?
Well, two people in 1909. But even at the outbreak of war in 1914, there were only 17 people. Imagine an FBI with only 17 people, and 17 included the caretaker. But they were very well-motivated people. They had the support of the police service. They had the support of Winston Churchill. My goodness, that's always been important to British intelligence the first half of the 20th century. So these 17 people actually rounded up the 22 main German spies in Britain. And if they hadn't done so, the Germans would have known when and where the Brits were going to arrive on the continent at the beginning of the First World War. I mean, God knows. I mean, the Germans nearly won in the first 6 weeks. All one could say is if they'd known where the Brits were coming, they would have had an even greater chance of winning then.
How is such a small group able to do that?
It was able to do that essentially because it had the support of the people who mattered. The provincial police in Britain tend to be looked down on by the London police. So this was the first time that anyone in London had really been nice to the provincial police, and they really responded to that. And then secondly, you know, Winston Churchill. If you're lucky, you get one Winston Churchill a century, but it's unreasonable to expect to do more than that. So in all kinds of ways, he was genius. I mean, you've already interviewed one Nobel laureate in literature. He was a Nobel laureate in literature, but he had a day job being prime minister and things like that as well.
Now, in this country, there was a resistance to doing this sort of thing. One of our secretaries of state, if I remember correctly, said, gentlemen, don't spy on each other. Now, MI5 and MI6, and I'm not sure how they divide their responsibilities, they were created in 1909
yes.
before there was a war. We created the OSS because yep. there was a war.
Well, it was Stimson who was Secretary of State in 1929. And then became Secretary of War at the beginning of the Second World War, who said, gentlemen, do not open each other's mail. Mm-hmm. And you and I, being gentlemen, we don't open other people's mail, do we? But before the First World
My
War...
My staff opens my mail. Should I be concerned?
I obviously can't comment on that. But before the First World War, I mean, this was the last point at which the British were gentlemen. And we really did not open foreigners' mail. So the French ambassador in London, who was a man called Paul Cambon, and his brother Jules Cambon was French ambassador in Berlin. He didn't correspond via the French diplomatic bank because then, as no doubt now, the bureaucrats in the French foreign ministry, the Quai d'Orsay, opened interesting letters. So he corresponded with his brother by the one method of communication that was absolutely beyond reproach. That is to say, the British diplomatic bank. Don't try it now, Leonard. It doesn't work any longer.
Now, the focus of MI5 changed between World War I and World War II, didn't it?
Absolutely. Before the First World War, by far the main problem we had was the coming of the First World War and German spies. But between the war, it was a little bit confused. Nobody could have predicted that Europe's most reactionary monarchy, Russia, would turn by the end of the First World War into the world's most revolutionary regime, which is a good example of the fact that they're really important things that can't be predicted. But actually, by the beginning of the Second World War, of course, things had shifted back. The main target was once again Germany.
You tell a story that sounds like something that's occurred many times. Intelligence comes up with important information, and then the people who have to then act upon it don't pay any attention.
No, but MI5 was the first intelligence agency to discover how, if politicians, policymakers, really will not listen, how to get them to listen. And how you get them to listen is to tell them that their main opponent, in this case, they told Neville Chamberlain, who was the intellectually challenged British Prime Minister before the outbreak of the Second World War, that Adolf Hitler was calling him, can I say the word?
No.
All right, I can't say
but,
it.
But he was calling him...
But it begins with A.
Yeah, and ends with an E.
And ends with
and
an
a
E.
A bunch of letters
and his eight
in between.
Letters, but we can't speculate on what it might have been.
And so that motivated him to act. Finally, it was not all the other things that Hitler was doing.
He was very upset. Because the British Foreign Secretary, who was not intellectually challenged but was very pompous and well brought up. His name was Lord Halifax. He had never seen this word beginning with A and ending in E written down before. And on the way to the Prime Minister, he underlined it three times in red. So this is the first and the last time in British history, and I think this has never happened in American history, in which a word like that underlined three times in red was forwarded to either the President or the Prime Minister.
Could you explain the double-cross system?
I could explain the double-cross system. That's what we Brits do when we're really desperate. We fool absolutely everybody all of the time instead of just some of the people some of the time. So, I mean, the problem during the Second World War is that once Hitler had gained control of the continent, how on earth are we going to wrest it from him? Well, the first thing we always do when there's a real war going on is get the Americans involved. But even once Dwight D. Eisenhower had become supreme Allied commander, the problem is that in a week, during the D-Day landings, the liberation of occupied Europe, we can get six divisions on land if we're lucky. There are 60 on the other side. So the only way of being able to do it is to persuade the German high command and Hitler that, the landings have taken place in Normandy. Don't be fooled by them. They're just a deception, a diversion. Where they're really going to come is in the obvious place, the part of France which is closest to Britain, Calais. And Hitler was so comprehensively fooled that he gave Garbo, the code name of Juan Pujol, who was the double agent, the heart of the double cross system, the Iron Cross for fooling him.
So disinformation became a part of this. Were the British the only ones using disinformation? I'd imagine.
No, we Brits, when we really put mind to it, because, you know, I look, and indeed am, at such an honest and decent sort of individual that nobody in the audience, for example, could possibly imagine that I might deceive anybody, could they? Mm-hmm. And that's why we British are so much more effective at deceiving people than other people who don't look so incredibly honest and gentlemanly as I do.
What's been the role of women in British intelligence? Were they there from the start?
Oh, well, you see, that's the big secret. It can't be said that in general terms that Britain has led the way in breaking the glass ceiling. But actually, the glass ceiling within Britain was first broken in MI5. Now, part of that is unclassified. In 1992, Stella Remington becomes the first woman to become head of any of the world's major intelligence agencies, head of MI5. But it all goes back to the First World War. So what the men in MI5 did during the First World War was decide, why don't we have the cleverest secretaries in Britain? And they did. And the problem was that some of them were embarrassingly cleverer than the men. I'll just give you one example. There's a 16-year-old secretary who's recruited straight from school in 1916. You'll find her name, actually, in Philby's memoirs, where he describes it as about the smartest intelligence officer he ever met. 8 years later, 1924, she has qualified as barrister, and she's MI5's leading Soviet expert. You know, in the State Department, in any intelligence agency anywhere in the world, there wasn't a 16-year-old secretary who 8 years on had got that job.
Weren't some of the most successful double-cross agents during World War II women?
The problem is that during the Second World War, the Germans did not listen to women. Uh-huh. And therefore, horses for courses, it had to be men who fooled the Germans, I regret to say.
My guest is Christopher Andrew, who has written an unprecedented history called Defend the Realm, the authorized history of MI5. It's published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're broadcasting live from the Jerome L. Green Space at WNYC on the corner of Carlton and Barrack Streets. I also wanted to alert you to the fact that Kurt Anderson will be taping a show on Tuesday, November 17th, for Studio 360, live here at the Green Space. Kurt will be looking at how time travel has been imagined in fiction and movies and whether it's possible in real life, with guests that include sci-fi writer Connie Willis and a live performance with neo-soul singer Janelle Monáe. And you can join them. That's next Tuesday, November 17th at 7 p.m. For more information, including a full lineup of guests and tickets, visit wnyc.org/thegreenspace. This is WNYC and wnyc.org. We're back at the Jerome L. Green Performance Space, and my guest is Christopher Andrew, Britain's leading historian of intelligence, professor of modern and contemporary history, and a former chair of the Faculty of History at Cambridge University. He's also chair of the British Intelligence Study Group and the founding co-editor of Intelligence and National Security. He has written Defend the Realm, the authorized history of MI5, which is published by Knopf. There was reluctance to recruit Jews into MI5. Why?
No, absolutely. I mean, at least I have not hesitated when I have found something appalling that happened. Talk about it. The reason was that MI5 has now forgotten that the first counter-terrorist problem it had to deal with was actually extreme Zionism. And this was the period when Zionists in the future state of Israel understandably wanted the Brits to clear out as quickly as possible. So they blew up the King David Hotel in 1946, the head of the British administration in Jerusalem. Then they got close to home, halfway to home, blew up the British embassy in Rome. And then they planted a huge bomb in Whitehall, which failed to go off. But if it had gone off, it would have killed just as many people as were killed in Jerusalem. So the MI5 leadership, there's no justification for it, but it nonetheless, for the next 25 years, just about the most shocking thing it's ever done, did not recruit Jews because it feared that they would have dual loyalty to the state of Israel as well as to Britain.
Well, they also recruited from Cambridge, upper-class people, so there was this kind of a WASP sensibility there. That led to what, I don't know whether it was, but what I would assume was the worst crisis that MI5 faced, and we talked about it earlier, the Cambridge Five.
Leonard, we're talking about double standards. Okay. Where I have found double standards, I have identified them. KGB was sufficiently sneaky to play on people's MI5's belief. It's, look, you're not going to be prejudiced against this student just because he or she had left-wing ideas when they're a student. No, obviously not. No, it was a huge error. No question about that. But at least I have talked about huge errors when I found them.
Well, Harold Evans was on our show the other day, and he, when he was editing, I think it was the Sunday Times, he revealed that Kim Philby had been a spy, and he was attacked for doing that.
Well, he wasn't attacked by sensible people, but nonetheless, yeah, it was extremely embarrassing. But far more embarrassing than revealing people who had been spies was revealing people who it was alleged had been spies and who hadn't. So in those far-off days when an elderly British gent who happened to be Prime Minister Harold Macmillan was attempting to form a special relationship with a bright young American president half his age, John F. Kennedy, and succeeded, the single most embarrassing thing that Macmillan ever had to tell Kennedy was that the past deputy head of MI5 was being investigated on a charge of being a Soviet spy. And he was completely innocent. But the problem was that having found real Soviet spies, and to some extent the same thing happened in the United States with Angleton.
Yes. It set up James Jesus Angleton.
That's right. It set up a sort of a period of paranoia in which you thought, my God, If Philby was a spy, who else might have been a spy?
But MI5 was investigating Harold Wilson himself.
It was investigating Harold Wilson, but without ever seriously believing that he was a spy. For some extraordinary reason, though, Harold Wilson, who was a completely uncorrupt individual, had led a very sheltered life in Yorkshire. And the most exciting evening out he ever had, I think, until he became Prime Minister, was buying a pork pie and a little bit of pickle to go with it. But then he met these crooked businessmen, and he was absolutely fascinated by them. So one of them, whose name was Kagan, and then thanks to Wilson, was knighted and then became Lord Kagan, we now know, and the book gives the evidence. Every week for 7 years, met an met a KGB officer and passed on what he'd learned from Harold. So there wasn't a problem with Harold, but there was a huge problem with Harold's friends.
There were other Labour Party MPs who were also members of the party, who were secretly working for the party?
Well, the irony was that, I mean, there is this belief in Britain that what MI5 was doing during the Cold War was looking for Reds under beds, sometimes finding Reds in beds, and then trying to persuade a supine government that this mattered. It's absolutely the other way around. Successful governments, particularly when there were strikes in England, you're old enough to remember when there was a strike more or less every week in Britain. The government believes that communists were behind this. Well, mostly communists were not behind this, and it was MI5 who were calming them down. But just before Wilson becomes Prime Minister, 1964, the Labour leadership brings to MI5 a list of 16 Labour members of Parliament who it believes are really communist. MI5 regards this as rubbish, and with one exception, it was rubbish. But the lead is coming from the politicians and not from MI5.
Well, one of the biggest scandals involved a Conservative Member of Parliament, Profumo.
It was the kind of scandal that if he'd admitted what he was doing, I don't think it would have been very much a scandal. He had the same girlfriend, the same lover, as Yevgeny Ivanov, who happened to be a Soviet intelligence officer in Britain. If he'd admitted it, I don't think there would have been much of a scandal, but he did admit it, and there are some details in the book. What Ivanov did is something that wouldn't work in New York. When he fancied a woman who he had met, he asked to borrow her lipstick, and then he wrote on the back of the menu card, and there is a picture in the book, his contact details. You know, we led, at the end of rationing, we were sort of very seriously deprived in Britain. We had no real excitement in life, so if a Soviet officer sort of gave his contact details in a woman's lipstick, we just fell for it every time, but no. New York is much more cosmopolitan, sophisticated society. It would never have worked here.
Christine Keller was a kind of a loose cannon anyway. Would she have been effective as a spy?
Good heavens, no. No, it was a very sad story. She was abused as a child. She was abused as an adult. And, she would never have been able to achieve anything of any significance whatever, I feel.
How was the IRA a different kind of threat than others that MI5 faced?
Well, MI5, in a sense, could have won in the 1990s. What I think is not realized on this side of the Atlantic, it's not widely realized in Britain, is that even though MI5 was responsible for counterterrorism, it was not until 1992, only 17 years ago, get the lead role in dealing with Irish Republican terrorism. Now, in the 90s, the IRA, for the first time, had worked out a strategy which might have led them to some kind of victory in mainland Britain. They decided to blow up the City of London, which was then our pride and joy, but we're not so clear about that now.
Well, the trains used to run on time in those days.
I don't remember that period, Leonard. We must talk about that afterwards. But anyway, had they succeeded in blowing up as many foreign financial institutions as they intended, then I think foreign financial institutions would have relocated. But MI5 discovered that they were up to, they stopped doing it, and in the end, this is my take, the IRA realized that they weren't going to win by violence, and they settled for negotiation.
But you say that in the early 1970s, the service knew more about Nairobi than it did about Belfast.
Absolutely.
They've been ignoring Northern Ireland.
Yes. Practically everybody ignored Northern Ireland, including what tends to be forgotten, the Irish Republic. The best historian of the security policies of the Irish Republic says that in 1970, Dublin knew as much about Belfast as it did about Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea. In other words, there was this small area of six counties in the north of Ireland, which Dublin didn't pay any serious attention to, London didn't pay serious attention to, and got in a hell of a mess partly as a result of that.
What happened in Gibraltar in 1988?
Well, the remarkable thing was that even though MI5 did not until 1992 have the lead intelligence role in dealing with IRA attacks on the British mainland, it had the lead role in dealing with IRA attacks against British interests in other parts of the world. And there was a very soft target in Gibraltar. There's a changing of the guard once a week in Gibraltar, so attacking the British garrison while it was changing the guard seemed like a good idea. But the individuals who were involved were under surveillance. There's some pictures in the book of Siobhan O'Hanlon, the woman who was making the initial reconnoitre. And because they were spotted, it didn't happen. Then there was this very controversial end in which the IRA group were shot. It was discovered afterwards that they were unarmed. There are two ways of looking at it. It was deliberate British shoot to kill, and the other way, which I happen to, it's entirely possible for people to take a different view, is that the Brits thought that following their usual modus operandi, the IRA people were armed, and therefore the only solution was to shoot them before they exploded a big car bomb.
Was MI5 involved in those shootings?
MI5 was not involved in the shooting. MI5 has no power of arrest, does not carry guns. The army does the shooting. The police do the arresting.
How has the service coped with transnational terrorism? Is it true that as recently as the 1990s it wasn't considered a serious threat by MI5?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the reason is the same as in many other places in the West. You know, just to make a brief analogy, I've noticed on the London Tube, financiers reading books with exciting titles like 1929 and The Great Crash. You know, when did they pay attention to anything that happened more than 6 months ago until recently? So the problem was that with terrorism in the mid-1990s, even though there were a limited number of academics, the most important of whom was the American academic Bruce Hoffman, who said, look, take the long view. The problem of the early 21st century is going to be holy terror. It's going to be Islamist terror. MI5 was dealing on a day-to-day business with serious IRA attacks. Did not take long view.
And it wasn't until 9/11 that they started paying attention?
Well, they started paying attention a little bit ahead of that because what is not realized is that the first major attack, planned attack, against Britain and the United States was actually not in the United States on 9/11. It was in Britain the year before, and that was stopped at a fairly early stage. But ever since 9/11, the main struggle of MI5 has been to prevent there being a British 9/11, and 3 years ago it almost happened. Mm-hmm. There was a plot that would have killed more people than on 9/11 here, and the trial at the end of that plot was only concluded 2 months ago in September. What it was for seven aircraft to have suicide bombers on them, with an innocuous-looking kind of bomb, which was just looked like soft drinks, except it contained hydrogen peroxide. What was the detonator? It was the flash on a disposable camera you could buy in the airport. The only reason it was stopped in time, this is the difference with 9/11. The 9/11 suicide hijackers were not under surveillance beforehand. These people were under surveillance beforehand, and they were stopped in time.
Was the intelligence leading up to the Iraq war that the Bush administration cited as coming from Britain from MI5?
That was, no, that was not MI5, because MI5 has a worldwide remit for counterterrorism, but it doesn't have a worldwide remit for foreign intelligence. That's MI6. You know, there was a huge mistake. The only debate is not whether it was a mistake, not whether it had terrible consequences, it did, but whether it was a really stupid mistake. What was going on is that we were able to listen in to what Saddam Hussein was saying. Saddam Hussein, in public, was saying, "We ain't got him." In private, he was saying to his advisors, "Don't you bother. We've got him." You know, but here's the first known example in his life in what he was saying in public was true and what he was saying in private was a lie. We should still have worked it out, but at least it wasn't quite as stupid a mistake as is often believed.
One of the interesting things that you reveal in the book is that there's an odd element of humor in MI5.
Yes, very odd, I would say.
Is this gallows humor?
No, I don't think so. I think the first organization that I know of anywhere in the world that identified as far back as the First World War a sense of humor as something desirable to look at to identify new recruits was MI5. Now, there are two reasons, one which everyone here knows, which is that it's easier to work with people who have a sense of humor than people like Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin who don't. And... to name only two. But the other thing is if you're dealing with really desperate stuff, and anyone dealing with counterterrorism now, in the age of the weapons of mass destruction, this is desperate stuff. Unless you have some kind of sense of humor, you don't have a sense of proportion.
We only have about a minute left, but I have to ask you the question I'm sure everyone asks you. How accurate are the spy characters? Well, James Bond is a total figment of imagination, but what about George Smiley?
Look, James Bond has done us an awful lot of good because he's the brand leader. I mean, Coca-Cola has had more trouble with Pepsi since 1953 than James Bond has had. So just one example, head of British intelligence, when he was a young officer in the late 1950s, he goes to the Third World to interview a tribal leader. He assumes the tribal leader knows no English. He did know no English, with the exception of the one sentence that a majority of the world's population know, and he greets him with it, "Hello, Mr. Bond."
John le Carré, is he more accurate?
John le Carré was in both MI5 and MI6. You know, one of the great perks of being in British intelligence is you get to write these really exciting novels afterwards.
Christopher Andrew has written an exciting history, Defend the Realm, the authorized history of MI5, published by Knopp. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.
And on tomorrow's show, Philippe de Montebello, now the Director Emeritus of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, after heading it for 31 years, will be talking with us. Also, Granta editor John Freeman on what he calls the tyranny of email. Then Michelle Honeyvan on her latest novel, Blame, plus our latest underreported segments. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Fran Jacobs, Barbara Kahn, Colin Adams-Toomey, and Stephanie Bernhardt. Debbie Fountain and Jason Isaac were at the audio controls. Special thanks to the Green Space team, technical director Gil Schuster, production manager Nikki Johnson, box office manager Jenny Langsam, and technical coordinator Nell Schmidt-Roth. The executive producer of the Green Space is Indira Etwaru. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.